Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. One of God's glories, of course, is planet Earth. And we are told that man is despoiling it, that the production and use of fossil fuels, as they're called, has warmed the planet to the point of crisis. And that if it is not rectified by slashing the use of such fuels, coal, oil, natural gas, well, the kinds of terrible storms and other apocalyptic environmental conditions will, well, take us down, really lead to the destruction of humankind as we have known it and been part of it for these many, many, many centuries, indeed millennia. We're going to talk with a man who takes a profoundly dissenting view on all of that. His name is Gregory Wrightstone. He is, among other things, the executive director of something called the CO2 Coalition. Coalition whose central purpose is to actually extol the virtues of CO2, carbon dioxide, not end its use or deeply constrict it. He is a geologist by training, and we'll talk with him about why he has insights into atmospheric issues. We'll also talk to him about his work as a reviewer for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, said to be the authoritative expert group commissioned by the United Nations to assess all of this. He is the author of a best-selling book entitled Inconvenient Facts, and a brand new book, hot off the presses literally today, entitled A Very Convenient Warming. And its subtitle is How Modest Warming and More CO2 Are Benefiting Humanity. Gregory Wrightstone, welcome back to Securing America. It's always, if I could use the expression, a breath of fresh air to have you with us. And I look forward to hearing about your new book, as well as your exploits with the CO2 Coalition.
Oh, well, it's a really great story of hope that I bring here during this holiday season. It's an uplifting true story, actually. And that is that of the modest warming we've seen. About a degree of warming since 1900. That modest warming combining with more CO2 is leading, by almost every metric you look at, our ecosystems are thriving and prospering, and humanity is benefiting from the warming and the more CO2. I call it the greatest untold story of the 21st century.
It's an untold story, Greg. It seems as though every effort is being made to prevent it from being told, for that matter. And just to get some of the facts straight here, you agree that the planet is warming a bit. Is it your view that man's production of carbon dioxide through the use of these hydrocarbons is materially affecting the warmth of the planet?
Yeah, let's dive into that first. Is it warming? Yes, we are in a warming trend, but it's been warming in fits and starts. And in fact, up until the last couple of months, since 2016, the last 7 years, we've seen virtually no warming. Actually, just a slight cooling over those 7 years. So it warms in fits and starts. And the warming, it's important to understand, this warming trend that we're in started more than 300 years ago. Long before we started adding CO2. That's an important part to the story. It's really, really important to know that if CO2 is the primary force driving temperatures, we should be able to recognize that bump of CO2 in the mid-20th century. Yet we saw that warming started in the late 17th century. So we had the first 250 years of this warming had to have been naturally driven, not CO2 driven.
Right. And so let me just ask you then, has it been accelerating dramatically, this warming of the temperatures since the advent of the internal combustion engine.
We're being told that. We're being told that the rate of warming is unprecedented on the scale of thousands of years. Well, no, it's not. Exactly. And we can get into that later. It's a fascinating story of the relationship between human history and temperature history. But if we look at the beginning of this warm period, it started warming and it was the depths of what was a little ice age, the coldest part of the last 10,000 years, most likely. And the first 40 years of that warming were warmed at a rate 10 times the 20th century average. So no, we had a period of 40 years of warming going back to the early 18th century that warmed 10 times faster than what it is today. And so what we're seeing here is CO2 a greenhouse gas? Yes. And because of that, will more of it cause a warming of the atmosphere? Yes. But it's very modest and greatly overwhelmed probably by these natural forces. Again,
give us some examples of what those natural forces are that would be impactful.
They're big drivers of temperature that are the astronomical cycles, the wobble of the Earth, the eccentricity of the Earth's orbit. A lot of people believe that it's variations in solar cycles that are driving the various temperature changes. If you're going to ask,
and there's also volcanoes, I understand.
Volcanoes have a cooling effect.
Yeah.
For the most part, whenever the biggest ones can cool for 4 and 5 years after the explosion, Tambora, Chichon, the really big ones.
So, but there are these very large naturally occurring forces that are affecting climate.
There are, and if we look over the last 10,000 years since the retreat of the last glaciers, there have been 9 other warming trends similar to what we're in today, all of those warmer than today. And we know that both by paleogeologic science, which is complicated, but we also know from historical records of, let's say, grape orchards and olive groves were farther north during those past warm periods. They were growing things like a crop called millet in Scandinavia during the Minoan warm period. Well, that's a tropical, semi-tropical plant, and they were growing it in Scandinavia. Historical records like that people look at and they go, okay, I get that. It had to have been warmer.
Right. But here's the question to you, sir, because I just want to get your bona fides here. The thing about being a geologist who knows something about paleogeology is that you have an advantage, arguably, over all of these atmospheric scientists who are looking basically at what's happening or has been demonstrably happening, what history, if you will, has recorded. But history has been a very short period of time, has it not? And what you've been looking at with rocks and sedimentary levels and so on goes back, you know, to the dawn of the planet.
It does, but it's not that I have an advantage. It's because they choose to avoid looking at that. Because if you look at history and human history and temperature history, you find pretty clearly that what they're talking about is just wrong. Because these cycles of warmth and cold have occurred time and time again. And again, I don't know why it warmed up during the Minoan, the Roman, and the medieval warm periods. We can come up with some ideas, but I don't, frankly, it's okay not to know. Yeah. We know that they occur.
It was not man-induced, I think.
It was not man-induced, and it's definitely not CO2, because CO2 is at very low levels. And again, I love, and you'll find in the book, I understand you've just received it and not had a chance to look through it, but there's a section on human history and temperature history that I find fascinating.
Yeah.
And we find the
bottom line of which, and we have to take a short break, is warmer climate, warmer temperatures are actually good for humankind, as well as productivity.
Not just good, very, very, very,
very, very, very good. We're talking with the author of a man who has written the book on the subject of very convenient warming. His name is Gregory Whitestone. We'll be right back with him right after this. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Among the most despicable acts so far in the 21st century were the horrors recently inflicted by Hamas and Palestinian civilians, including the beheading of infants, rape, torture, and dismembering of women, and setting entire families afire. It seems unimaginable that anyone would boast publicly of being, quote, happy to see, unquote, such egregious crimes against humanity, unless, that is, you're a Sharia supremacist like Niyad Awad. They deem such behavior to be divinely ordained. Awad runs the Council on American-Islamic Relations and its deep penetration of and legitimization by the U.S. government. He claims his comments were taken out of context. In fact, they simply confirm that CARE is actually a fundraising and political warfare arm of the Jihadist Muslim Brotherhood's Palestinian franchise, Hamas. CARE must be shut down, not legitimated further. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back. Gregory Wrightstone is in the house. He is the executive director of a terrific outfit. It's called the CO2 Coalition. It seems it's standing up for those of us who actually prefer, for example, to, exhale the stuff, among other things, as well as benefit from what it does for our planet, what it does for our economy, what it does for humankind. Gregory, I wanted to just pull out a couple of things that are going on that are cross purposes with what you're describing here. We've had a very interesting conversation with an old friend by the name of Congressman Steve King the other day on this program. And he was talking about this extraordinary, I don't know what else to call it, but a boondoggle that is being mounted now with the slush fund that the Biden administration got in the form of Inflation Reduction Act, but it is actually just money for Green New Deal projects to build 3,600 miles, I think he told us, of underground tunneling to capture CO2. What's up with that? And are you as concerned as he is about investing for this purpose and, in fact, misunderstanding the nature of CO2 and all of this?
Yeah, what they're trying to do, what they want to do is strip out CO2 from the atmosphere. There are several methods for doing it. None of them cost effective, or none of them very, number one, it's a really, really, really bad idea to be removing a highly beneficial molecule from the atmosphere. And it's an even worse idea. And it's an even worse idea when it costs huge amounts of money that don't need to be spent. And in fact, I've got a great story that you'll find. I just hired Dr. Byron Seporian. He's a PhD in chemical engineering. He was one of the top experts on carbon capture. He's written papers, traveled around the world promoting carbon capture, researching various aspects of how you do it. He got a hold of our book. It's called Challenging Net Zero, our study, read it, contacted Chairman Will Happer. They discussed things, and he realized that he was on the wrong side of this, that what he was doing was actually horribly wrong. And he contacted me and he said, Greg, I want to come work for you. I don't like what I'm doing. And he called me a few weeks later. He says, I really want to come to work with you. And I said, why is that? He says, well, I quit my job. He actually quit. Now, that's the bravery of a scientist that you very rarely see.
So what guided by the science, as they say, right?
Exactly.
As opposed to ideology or so just profit.
I hired him. He found a safe place to land here. He's now a full-time employee. He's research and science associate.
And you know what they say about converts. There's nothing like their zeal, so good on
Absolutely.
You. I'm sure he'll be a great force multiplier for you and your book, a very convenient warming. So, Greg, I just wanted to, pivot from this idea that so much energy and money and, hysteria is now associated with the fact that we've got to get these greenhouse gases somehow under control, not being produced, captured, put underground, what have you. And what was said by the convening president of all people of this so-called COP28, a conference of parties to the efforts to, you know, deal with climate change at the UN. What did the Sheikh in Abu Dhabi say about the science behind all of this? And yeah, how was it met?
That was Sultan Jabbar, who said that there was no science supporting this effort to ban fossil fuels, to get rid of fossil fuels. There's just no science behind it. He repeated it and doubled down on it. And he's absolutely correct. And heads were exploding when he said that. And God bless him. He said out loud what we believe and what Dr.
And from a very bully pulpit at that. Now, he was immediately dismissed because he's working on, you know, fossil fuels in the UAE, the United Arab Emirates. But it's the science. I mean, if you really have the wit and will to look at it that he was speaking about. So, again, just to make sure we've got our facts straight, the inconvenient facts, as you put them. You're saying that the people who are spending gajillions of dollars and promoting this hysteria that the world is ending and has poor Greta Thunberg and so many others, I mean, literally, I think millions of kids across this country now traumatized by the prospect that the world is going to end any day now. AOC of Congress being a prime example. What do you say to these people? What are you trying to communicate to them in your new book, A Very Convenient Warming?
We should celebrate more CO2 and warming. And in fact, we just started a six month run in Salt Lake City of a billboard that's rotating digital. And there's a woman resting comfortably in her bed, and the billboard says, "Sleep well, there is no climate crisis." And that's true, but what we've done and what I've done in this book is move beyond there is no climate crisis. And that's true, there is no climate crisis. But we've moved beyond that from not just saying there is no climate crisis to not only is there not a crisis, Earth is improving and its ecosystems are thriving and prospering. We're experiencing reforestation, not deforestation. Deserts are shrinking, not expanding. Droughts are in decline. Forest fires worldwide are declining. We could go on.
Desertification is receding. Now we're losing a lot of glaciers, I'm told, and polar bears are struggling. And is that not true either?
Are glaciers receding? You bet they are. We're in a warming trend. That's what happens when it warms. But you have to look, probably the glacier that most people see is the Mendenhall Glacier outside of Juneau. My wife and I took a helicopter ride to the top of that. And if we, or Glacier Bay, if we look there, many people take the boat cruises. Glacier Bay has receded some 60 miles. 50 miles of that occurred before 1950 when we started adding CO2 to the atmosphere. It started actually retreating around 1800. And so that retreat from 1800 to 1950, 150 years of that was all natural.
Yeah.
Nothing to do with
But here's what we're told is the crisis. And it was much in evidence at this COP28 exercise. The melting of those glaciers as a result of whatever forces is raising the sea level, and islands like Tuvalu are going to be lost forever. And we need to spend lots of people's money, including ours, redistributing it to improve the lives or the Tuvaluans some new place to live. Is that true?
Tuvalu, let's look at this. Tuvalu is barely above sea level. And, they're pretty safe. You know, in a large storm, it gets problematic. 15,000 years ago, Tuvalu was also just above sea level. In that 15,000 years, sea level has risen 400 feet. Yet, here's Tuvalu, just above sea level. Why is Tuvalu not now 400 feet underwater? That's because of a geologic process known as accretion. These islands grow naturally as sea level rises. It's the near shore sediments get washed up onto the island during storm events, the gravels and the sands. And it's a slow process, but over thousands. And that's why Tuvalu, the Maldives, and these other at-risk islands are not underwater. If we look at the current sea level rise, as measured by tide buoys, the average by 1950, the sea level will rise 2 inches, okay, barely to your ankles. So what they're telling you is, well, that last 400 feet of sea level rise didn't put them under. That next 2 inches, look out, they're going to be underwater.
Miami will be gone, the whole coast. Exactly. We have to leave it at that for the moment, but we want you back. Gregory Wrightstone, this is so fascinating. And the fact that I think we're being subjected to a massive fraud here is a point that I want people to take away. Check out a very convenient warming, Gregory Wrightstone's new book, following on to Inconvenient Facts. God bless you, my friend. Good luck with the CO2 Coalition. Come back soon. We'll be right back with more with Carolyn Glick right after this.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. It's a delight to be able to say welcome once again to a dear friend and very, very valued colleague at our Center for Security Policy, where she is a senior fellow, among many other things. She is the host of the Carolyn Glick Show, terrific podcast, which I commend to all of you. It is just one of her outputs, or outlets, I should say. One of the others is the Jewish News Syndicate, where she is a featured columnist. She is also the author of two terrific books, Shackled Warrior and The Israel Solution, and a just go-to resource for, I think, people throughout the free world about what is happening in Israel, what is happening in the region, what it means for all of us, as well as, of course, for our friends in Israel. Carolyn Glick, it's great to have you back. Thank you for finding some time for us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on your program. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Frank.
Great. Well, let me start by asking you to give us an update from your perspective on the state of the war that has been precipitated, of course, by the horrific attack by Hamas against Israel on the 7th of October.
Yeah. Right now, our ground operations, we had a 7 day or so suspension of the ground operation in Gaza while we were carrying out hostages for terrorists swap with Hamas, during the course of which we were able to get about 100 or more, actually, of our hostages out of Gaza. They were predominantly children and women who are held. We still have 17 young women who are being held hostage there, most of them between the ages of 18 and 26, and we're very, very concerned about the sexual abuse that they're likely undergoing there. And then we have the rest of the 137 hostages in Gaza are male, and they've also clearly been undergoing serious torture body mutilation. We've seen evidence of this already. The hostages who were free have told some of what they've gone through. We know some of it, and they were brutalized both physically and psychologically at the hand of their captors. So this is really a hostage crisis unlike any that we've seen ever, I think, in modern times.
Right. There are those who say because it's so egregious, a hostage crisis, that there has to be a ceasefire that will enable more of them to be set free. What are your thoughts on that proposition, Carolyn?
I understand it. The problem is that the same barbarians who are doing this to our people are at war with all of us, and they seek the annihilation of the Jews. And what we saw on October 7th and what we're seeing now with the hostages is that we simply cannot, we can no longer cohabitate this area alongside them. Israel can't survive if Hamas is able to survive this battle. And so any ceasefire that's going to undermine Israel's ability to eradicate Hamas in Gaza, destroy the regime, destroy its ability to fight, to destroy all aspects of its control over Gaza, is going to be an end to a war that's going to imperil Israel. It's going to invite further aggression, not only from Gaza, but from the Palestinians in Judea and Samaria, from Hezbollah, which we'll talk about in a second, in the north, from Iran, from the Houthis in Yemen, and from a lot of other quarters. And it's also going to put an enormous amount of pressure on the Arab states that live at peace with Israel to join this war, because we'll have been exposed as so weak. So I understand the emotional pull of that argument, but you have to put the, I think I'm going to have one of the guests on my show this week is Tzvika Moore, the father of Eitan Moore, who's a 23-year-old hostage. And he and his friends, whose sons are also being held hostage, were taken with his son, Tzvika. They were doing security at the dance party in southern Israel that was attacked. So their view is very clear that you have to understand that the collective comes before the individual in times of war. And so that's
gotta
how
be
we feel.
Tremendously courageous thing for him to do, yep. Given that it probably is not going well with his son. Carolyn, I just have to ask you on a question that is on a lot of our minds, and that is public opinion polling and a lot of anecdotal evidence certainly indicates that there's broad support within the Gazan community for Hamas. So mm-hmm. when you lay out, as I think we have to, a very draconian response to Hamas. What is your view of what you do about the Palestinian population of Gaza that supports it, that I think, in fact, has indicated that it strongly approves of what was done to the people of Israel on the 7th of October, for example?
Well, first of all, I think that, you know, you're going to see a lot of people leaving Gaza because there's nowhere for them to be safe in Gaza. I think Hamas is trying to push them into Egypt to open up another front against the war and to destabilize the regime of Assisi. But Assisi very wisely, according to reports yesterday, is looking for Arab states that will accept them. So, you know, we may see that happening, and I think that's a very important thing to happen at the end of the war. I think that many of these people simply can't be allowed to remain there. I think that, you know, that they pose an existential threat to the Jews, and so, you know, to the extent that the Turks like them, the Turks should take them. To the extent that the Qataris are their state sponsor, the Qataris should take them. Mm-hmm. You know, but I think
have they evidenced any interest in doing that, either of them?
I don't know why we have to ask them, but you know, I know that Chechnya has taken several thousand Gazans already. So maybe the Chechnyans want them. So I think, yeah, why not? They will fit in, although the Taliban may think that they're too radical. But I think that you know, the main point here is that we can't allow the Palestinian Authority, which is backed by the United States, to take over Gaza, because the Palestinian Authority itself, right now, they're Hamas's junior partners. Their terrorists also carried out atrocities on October 7th. They joined as an auxiliary force along with Islamic Jihad, and thousands of everyday Gazans came in and looted our villages and raped our women and took hostages that day and slaughtered Jews that day. So I think it's very important. And also, there's not one person in the Palestinian Authority who has condemned what Hamas did in any way. And Mohammed Shtaya, who's supposed to be a technocrat, just said, you know, he's meeting with the Americans. He's working with them on the post-war scenarios. He was in Qatar this weekend doing that. He said that they want to form a unity government with Hamas. So, you know, these people are not going to be capable of doing what needs to be done in Gaza in order to denazify that society. And that society is the same situation, by the way, in Judea and Samaria, where you have even higher levels of support for what Hamas did than you have among the people of Gaza.
Right. So, Carolyn, you have, as I mentioned earlier, written a book entitled mm-hmm. The Israel Solution. The Israeli solution, a direct sort of rebuttal to the idea that a two-state solution right. is either in the cards or certainly desirable. And yet we hear the Biden administration and even people who are avowedly very supportive of Israel. Lindsey Graham comes to mind, just I think in Dubai or wherever he was, talking up this idea that that's where we need to go. What's your response to that?
Yeah, you know, we have to stop looking at the two-state solution as sacrosanct. It was always a delusion. It was always based on this delusion that the reason that there's no peace between Israel and the Arabs, or later between Israel and the Palestinian Arabs, is because of the size of Israel, that there's something wrong about Israel controlling its ancestral homeland, that we've seized it from somebody else. You know, we haven't.
Hold the thought, Carolyn. Mm-hmm. This is such an important point. The question is even whether it can control even parts of its ancestral right. homeland, as you know. We'll be right back with more with mm-hmm. Carolyn Glick of The Carolyn Glick Show at carolynglick.com. Stay tuned.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Among the most despicable acts so far in the 21st century were the horrors recently inflicted by Hamas and Palestinian civilians, including the beheading of infants, rape, torture, and dismembering of women, and setting entire families afire. It seems unimaginable that anyone would boast publicly of being, quote, happy to see, unquote, such egregious crimes against humanity, unless, that is, you're a Sharia supremacist like Nihad Awad. They deem such behavior to be divinely ordained. Awad runs the Council on American Islamic Relations and its deep penetration of and legitimization by the U.S. government. He claims his comments were taken out of context. In fact, they simply confirm that CARE is actually a fundraising and political warfare arm of the Jihadist Muslim Brotherhood's Palestinian franchise, Hamas. CARE must be shut down, not legitimated further. This is Frank Affney.
We're back. Carolyn Glick is with us virtually from Israel, where she lives. She made Aliyah a number of years ago,
American
originally, and we're always very proud of our association with her. She is these days a senior contributing editor to the Jewish News Syndicate, where she has a wonderful column. Also, check out her show, The Carolyn Glick Show. Carolyn, we were talking about the two-state solution. We were talking about its delusional origins. We're talking about it being even more delusional today. And yet it is what we keep hearing people default back to, despite what you said about the, you know, the underlying realities, especially that not only are the Gazans fully on board with Hamas, it appears, but so as a practical matter, the Palestinians elsewhere in the West Bank, the Palestinian Authority. So how do we break through this idea that somehow it's not just sacrosanct, but it's inevitable that there will be a two-state solution involving, unfortunately, not two states living side by side in peace?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that one of the biggest public arguments, anyway, between the Israeli government and the Biden administration these days is that the Biden administration insists that Israel has to commit to a two-state solution now and reconstruction of Gaza immediately afterwards. I mean, I want them to be pledging billions of dollars in international aid to rebuild southern Israel, which was invaded. You know, I think that that should be the first priority after the war is over from any sort of international community that values human life. But be that as it may, I think that the fact is that the day after, such as it is, as in Israel's view, involves Israel controlling Gaza, because there is no other force that can be trusted to maintain a situation where Hamas and other jihadist elements aren't able to rebuild their power. There's nobody that can be trusted to do this, not UN forces, not some sort of imaginary Arab League force that's going to come in and be opposed to it. What we found throughout our entire 75 years is that every time that there's an international force brought into a border area, whether it's in the Golan Heights or in the Sinai or in Lebanon, or in Judea and Samaria or in Gaza, they never do anything except protect Israel's enemies and create a buffer to make it very difficult for Israel to defeat enemy forces that are attacking it. And they often attack them from UN facilities. And as happens now every single day in Gaza, UNRWA, the UN Refugee Works Association or agency that operates in Gaza, is supposedly neutral. It's totally not neutral. Almost everybody in UNRWA is a Hamas terrorist, and all of their installations are being used as terror bases against Israel. So I think it's very important to point this out. And we can only trust ourselves. I mean, we cannot place our security in the hands of any other force.
Yeah. You know, I'm so appreciative that you've helped calibrate on UNRWA. As you know, Carolyn, one of its former employees is now the director of intelligence on Biden's National Security Council. What could possibly go wrong? Well, in point of fact, a lot's going wrong. And I want to come to the United States and its impact on all of this in a moment with you, Carolyn. But before we do, you mentioned Lebanon. You said we were going to talk about Hezbollah. I think that's imperative that we find a little bit of time to do that. Israel is clearly recognizing that it can't live with Hezbollah with its 150,000 or more rockets and missiles either. What are you forecasting on that front?
Well, right now it looks like war is inevitable. War is inevitable from Israel's perspective because there's no way to sufficiently degrade the strategic threat that Hezbollah's combined force of hardened veterans from the Hezbollah wars in Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan poised at our border, along with that massive missile arsenal posed to Israel. We can't let the 60,000 Israelis who have been evacuated from their homes along the border, in the border communities, go home until that threat is massively degraded. We can't secure northern Israel. We can't secure any of our installations in the country so long as that threat is not degraded. And
because those missiles can range the entirety of the nation.
I mean, they can take out all of our air bases. They can take out all of our highways. They can take out all of, I mean, they reach every single square centimeter of Israeli territory. And we're not talking about little pipe bombs. We're talking about bombs with payloads of up to 2 tons, you know, and they're precision guided. So this is not, we're facing a missile threat to Israel that's more profound than South Korea faces from North Korea. And, you know, we have to degrade it. And really, the only way to do it successfully is if we shape the battlefield, which means that we have to open the hostilities. And obviously, if the carrier groups that the United States sent to the region were here in order to promote peace, and they would be wanting to do that alongside with Israel. The problem is that the Biden administration has made its goal preventing war. And that was fine very beginning when Israel wasn't ready for a war and we needed to deploy our army and we evacuate our civilians from the northern border. But we can't actually accept an end of the war where Hezbollah is on the border. So now the American war goal is at odds with Israel's existential need.
Mm-hmm. I'm so appreciative that you've used that term especially, because I think part of what's going on here in terms of the Biden administration, and I think frankly probably a lot of Americans, is a failure to recognize that that is exactly where Israel is. It's facing truly existential threats. And so the idea that it's being bruited that, Israel's going to have to stop the war at the end of the year, the war against Gaza, let alone getting into a new one with Hezbollah. And the prime minister is pushing back on that, to his credit, I think. But we're also watching, of course, the ratcheting up of the pressure. Another UN Security Council resolution is going to be offered within the next day or so. Carolyn, we're just counting, I guess, the minutes until Tony Blinken comes up with some new demand on Israel. And we have to pause for just one more final break. And when we come back, I want you to sort of lay out the U.S.-Israeli relationship today, informed by what it's been, of course, which has been not so good under Biden, but also what we here in the United States, who, you know, treasure Israel and want to make sure that it not only survives but thrives, can do to help at this moment. We'll be right back with more with Carolyn Glick, the host of The Carolyn Glick Show at carolynglick.com. Stay tuned. We're back. Carolyn Glick is with us for one more block, I'm very pleased to say. She is a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy, a very, very much admired colleague and resource. And Carolyn, I was just asking you about, sort of the, well, I call it the Obama-Biden 3.0 administration, because what we've seen particularly, but not exclusively, with respect to Israel reflects what Barack Obama was doing in his time. Where does that relationship stand now, and how do you see Israel navigating the kinds of pressures that are increasingly being brought to bear, among other things, on the supply of armaments? And I'm anxious to get your thoughts on what we can do to help.
Well, as they say, it's complicated. Our colleague at the Center for Security Policy, David Worms, wrote an article over the weekend, which I think was very important. And he used the metaphor of intersecting versus parallel lines. And he said essentially that the United States and Israel are intersecting lines. We're not parallel. We're not traveling together. We don't share the same goals in this war. There are some points of intersection, the main one being that the Americans completely agree that the slaughter, the Holocaust of October 7th is completely unacceptable and that Hamas has to pay a major price for it. But the U.S. policy relating to Israel, relating to the wider Middle East, remains the same policy that they had on October 6th. And that policy is a policy that seeks to realign the United States of America away from Israel and away from its traditional Sunni Arab allies and towards Iran and Iran's proxies, including Hezbollah, which controls Lebanon, and Hamas to a certain degree. Although Hamas sort of was harmed, obviously, by what they did on October 7th. But the Palestinians, as in larger form, as part of the what they refer to themselves as the resistance axis, which is the axis of jihad that seeks the annihilation of the state of Israel, and by the way, also of the United States of America. And so the United States under Biden has re-implemented Obama's policy of realigning the United States towards Iran and its proxies and the Muslim Brotherhood as well, and away from Israel and the Sunnis. And we see this very clearly in the way
that
the Biden...
Can I just say, Carolyn, this seems to be, if I may say, a great understatement. I mean, what they've done that I believe is vastly worse than anything Obama did, and that's hard to say, has been just relentless appeasement at every turn, even when our own forces are attacked by the Iranians, as they have been on scores of occasions, and our ships and others now being put under attack as well by Iranian proxies. But this is beyond Obama, I would say. But your point is that it's really bad, and it certainly is undermining Israel at every turn, is it not?
It is. I mean, you know, the United States is very much under attack. U.S. forces in Syria, U.S. forces in Iran, I mean, in Iraq, by Yemen, by Iran's Yemenite proxy, the Houthis, by Iranian militia in Syria, Hezbollah in Syria, in Iraq, are attacking the United States embassy. They're attacking U.S. forces. They're attacking U.S. bases. They're attacking U.S. shipping. They're attacking U.S. naval ships, naval craft in around the Bab el-Mandab in the Red Sea. And so these are all acts of war against the United States. And the Biden administration has really been refusing to take any action against this, so that American servicemen in these areas are truly sitting ducks here, because the United States won't do anything, because they want to preserve the policy. And the policy requires them to appease Iran, not to fight Iran. And that's what they're trying to force Israel to do as well. And the most dangerous place where that's really manifesting itself is not even in Gaza, it's in Lebanon. And again, you know, Amos Hochstein, the Lebanese papers just reported last week, I wrote about this in an article that came out in JNS yesterday, that they, the U.S. policy is to try to force Israel to surrender territory, much of it strategic, to Hezbollah-controlled Lebanon in order to prevent war. Right? And so they want Hezbollah to win. I mean, the Hochstein plan is a plan for a Hezbollah victory over Israel in this existential war. So will it avoid war for another 5 minutes? Yes, but is Israel going to be in even greater peril if we take this deal? Absolutely. Yeah, so I mean,
I'm not even sure advise you 5 minutes, Carolyn. I mean, you are absolutely emboldening both Hezbollah, of course, but also its sponsor. And this is a formula for utter disaster. And I just can't imagine that there isn't more of an outcry against it here in the United States. Amos is an individual I'm unfamiliar with. Where does he sit and who does he work for?
He's Biden's advisor on energy affairs. He was the one who...
Energy?
Oh. Yeah, he's a presidential advisor. He's the one who forced the maritime border agreement down Israel's throat last year, just before our election, when he was dealing with an interim government that was about to lose the elections.
And which gave Hezbollah access to gas wells
to the Qana natural gas platform. in the Eastern Mediterranean, which was supposed to give a steady source of income to Hezbollah. But amazingly, sort of in an act of God, I would say, a week after the Hamas attack, Total Energy, which carried out the exploration of the Qana gas field, said that it had no commercial value and that they had found water in the well. So, haha. But
that Hochstein, is a God thing.
Yeah, but Hochstein thought that there was. Everybody thought that it was a massive gas field, and he made Israel cough up our economic waters and our territorial waters and our share of the Qana gas platform to Hezbollah.
Okay. Last minute. What can Israel's friends in America, true friends in America, do to help at this moment?
I think it's really, really important for Congress to start bringing in for hearings people like Hadi Amar, who's the U.S. envoy to the Palestinians, who has a record of supporting Hamas. And he's deeply antagonistic towards Israel and towards its right to exist. And he is the one running the show on everything having to do with U.S. policy towards the Palestinians. He should be brought in to testify under oath before Congress about what he's doing and how the United States is trying to purge, to denazify Palestinian society, and why it is that the United States is arming and training a Palestinian army under the Palestinian Authority that is dedicated to the annihilation of the Jews.
An immortal threat to those in the West Bank as well as in Israel proper, mm-hmm. I'm afraid. Carolyn, thank you. This is an important call to action. We will amplify it everywhere and
thank you.
See what we can do to get it done. God bless you, my friends. Stay safe and keep reporting. We'll talk
thank
with you,
you
soon.
Thank
talk you. To the rest of you next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.